Hello, Bulls Nation. Welcome to another episode of the Rebuild the Bull podcast. I'm your host, Matt Gentile, and today my guest is Tony Gill from 670 The Score. He's the executive producer for the Lawrence Holmes Show, which can be heard middays from noon to 2. And he also covers the Bulls and has a podcast called the No Zones Podcast, which he does throughout the season. Tony was new to the Bulls beat this past year. Did a really awesome job capturing video, of course doing the podcast, and has really some good opinions about the Bulls, and I thought he would be a perfect guest to have on our show. We have, though, in this edition, something a little different. We cut this into two parts. One of the pieces of feedback I got was that, you know, the shows sometimes were a little long, and, you know, you'd like to consume it maybe in a short amount of time, you know, during lunch breaks, things like that. So we cut this episode into two parts. The first part, we'll dive into a lot of the rebuilding plan that has to do with the draft. And with the draft lottery being this Tuesday, I thought it would be good to have that part sort of earlier in the week. And maybe later in the week, part two will address some hypotheticals, but the discussion will be mainly focused on free agency and more of a long-term strategy after the 2020 season. So it won't really hinge on what happens with the lottery results on Tuesday night. So the first question that I asked Tony, though, is I wanted to get his thoughts on the recent change with the Lawrence Holmes Show. For the last 10 years, it had been an evening show, and it just, of course, got moved to middays. So wanted to get his thoughts on that change, and here's what he had to say.
Well, my sleeping schedule is probably the biggest change. at one point, I mean, people may call it like lazy or whatever, but since I didn't have to work, you know, until the evening time, I didn't have to wake up till like around noonish, you know, so that's different, you know, now waking up at, you know, seven for the noon show. But I mean, other than that, it's been a smooth transition, and I've had other opportunities to do like some different things, you know, either at the Score or other places, but I'm always a fan of when I'm most comfortable, I can do the best job that I can do. And working with Lawrence was that opportunity for me to do two things kind of at once, where one, I'm in the middle of the day executive producing a radio show in the city that I love, and I'm in the most comfortable working with the people that I'm most comfortable with Lawrence, with Rick Camp as my associate producer on that show. And they get the best out of me. I feel like I get the best out of Rick and Lawrence. And it's just so, it's such a fun, creative space that we invade in and that they allow us to have. And we're so different from the other two shows in the front and then behind us that it's just, I feel like it's a refreshing shakeup for our lineup, our big time lineup, the Score. And I really I believe that people are enjoying the kind of just the small shakeup of Lawrence now, getting to hear him during the day versus, you know, listen to his podcast because you weren't in the car at night or not at radio during the evening. So it's been a different change, but I think it's been a great change, not just for me, but for the station as well.
Yeah, and one thing he's always had, I felt like a vice grip on that nighttime slot for a long time, almost 10 years. And you look at going to that midday slot, does it make booking guests a little easier too?
Yeah, a lot easier. I don't get too many no's from people that want to, as you kind of seen so far in the show, we really harp on getting people in studio versus the phone. We love doing the traditional phone interview. That's not a problem for us. But what makes this show different is the amount of in-studio guests that we're getting and what we're trying to get. And during the day periods, people know that people are going to be watching either on Facebook Live or they're going to be listening on their radio because it's daytime radio. At night, it was a little bit more difficult because, one, games are going on typically at night. People are working typically at night, so it's more difficult to get the in-studio guests that we want. But during the daytime, it's fairly easy. The only difficult thing is getting guests to get through, you know, daytime traffic. But other than that, people have been more than willing so far of trying to come in studio with Lawrence, because not only is Lawrence respected in the medium and in the city and just nationwide wide in the craft that he has, but also it's a good show, and it's a good space for people, for guests to get, you know, notoriety during that daytime hour. So it's been very, very easy getting people to come in.
Lawrence Holmes show can be heard on 670 The Score weekdays from noon to 2. So aside from that show, though, you also host the No Zone podcast, which is a Bulls-themed podcast throughout the season. But you also are executive producer of Behind the Headlines, and that's hosted by Julie DeCaro. In the first season, you both took an in-depth look at the circumstances surrounding James Jordan's murder. For those, you know, kind of too young to remember, James Jordan was the father of Michael Jordan. He was murdered in 1993. How did Behind the Headlines come to be, and what was the experience like working on season one?
Well, I'm always thinking of ways or different ways to give people content. We're gonna, as you are doing here, this is a content business. I'm always, specifically The Score. I love The Score, and I always want to do things that's different from what The Score has done in this past. And right now, we are in the prime stage of digital and podcasting and on-demand listening. And I wanted to make sure that The Score was, and radio.com and Intercom are on top of that, that we are pushing the culture forward with podcasting. And fortunately enough, me and Julie, we were talking about this very topic, and, you know, different things that we can contribute, one, to increase our own brand, but also The Score's brand. And we just love podcasts, and she loves true crime podcasts specifically. I love great storytelling podcasts, so it doesn't really have to be true crime for me. But if you're telling a very great story, like Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History, it's probably my top three favorite podcasts of all time, where he's just telling stories in a very entertaining and informative way. And we just want to do that and present that. And how can we incorporate our love of sports with that? And this came about, the Behind the Headlines came as we were discussing that. And our boss, Mitch Rosen, greenlit it. And the experience working on it was phenomenal. I mean, Julie's knowledge, just with her prior career as a public defender, and her knowledge of the law, it really helped boost the confidence that I had in it going in with it with her. And it was just such a fun time, very informative. If you haven't checked it out, it's a fantastic podcast. I'm very proud of it. And season one, we just want to tell a fantastic story. And what better story to start with than the most iconic, not just Chicago sports figure, but the most iconic sports figure's father being murdered, and it not being looked at as it should have been with the notoriety of it and the seriousness of it, that it, we just felt like the complete story hasn't been told. And with the timing of it, with the defendant Daniel Green, who has been charged, convicted, and accused of the murder of James Jordan, him wanting to plead his innocence and not having that opportunity, we felt like this was the perfect story to start with for this podcast.
Yeah, and I definitely encourage our listeners to check it out. If, you know, again, if you like anything related, you know, not just to sports, but to crime, mystery, even legal genres, I think you'll thoroughly enjoy it. And again, that's Behind the Headlines. You can find that on 670thescore.com or really wherever you stream major podcasts. And one thing, just a quick aside, I thought you know, I heard your last episode, and you mentioned how you're kind of critical of your work. And I just thought that the audio presentation of it, the production behind it, was fantastic.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate it. This is like, you know, I've never done anything like this before, but I did, you know, listen to a couple other true crime podcasts just to kind of get me prepared for what was about to take place. And I definitely make sure I took my time with it, and make sure I did the story, you know, justice with the sound and the audio and the presentation of it, to make sure I set the setting accordingly, and also have people just really into it. And I really tried to do that with how I produced it. So I appreciate you saying that.
Awesome, man. I'm looking forward to season two. So I hope that gets started soon, because I'm waiting for more.
We have a meeting set up with our bosses and the people at Intercom. They really enjoyed it. And like, for side note, you're getting this into, we had a $0 budget for this podcast. They just wanted the content to be put on their website, but we didn't have a budget for it. So all the people that we got, they came on just, for free. And our bosses was willing to send us down, if you listen to our final episode, to send us down to North Carolina to get some live video and some interviews. So the support for it and this upcoming season is going to be great, and I'm definitely looking forward to it.
That's fantastic. It's amazing when you put out like that first season, you do all this, legwork and all that digging for basically with no money on, your budget. And now you're probably going to get some backing, I think, for season two. At least I hope. So you also covered, this was your first season covering the Bulls, correct? For
Correct.
the Score? How would you describe that experience? I can imagine just dealing with somebody like Jim Boylan almost on a daily basis is entertaining.
This season was very interesting, and I assume they won't be as many, ups and downs as a typical NBA season would go. But I mean, from the Jabari signing all the way through the Fred firing to the Boylan hiring to the mutiny in the beginning, like it's this season, I'm sure, isn't the norm for an NBA franchise. So I have to make sure that I'm reminded of that as we go to another this, the next season, that it may not be exciting. But it was certainly interesting learning from the room and my colleagues, Cody Westerlund, David Schuster, from just people here at the Score, but also the writers, Joe Cowley, Darnell Mayberry, Casey Johnson, Malika Andrews, like Kelly Kroll, like everybody in that room was so welcoming. And that was something that I worried about a little bit, because here's this new kid, what's he doing here? He doesn't write, or he's not a journalist, he didn't go to journalism school or anything like that. But it wasn't like that at all. Like, everybody was so open and willing to come on just my podcast, or willing to talk to me or give me pointers or something like that, that it was such a welcoming and amazing feeling that it made making those relationships or talking to the players and the coaches really easy, because everybody, either through listening to me via the Score or my opinions on like Twitter, which can get a little crazy, and I get that and get it out there. But I take basketball like seriously. It's my love, and I wanted their respect. And they were like, "No, you got it, you got it." And even when I had like a last question to kind of hold everybody up, nobody was like, "Oh, well, I don't care about this question. I'm just gonna go and do my work." Everybody stayed and found importance in what I was asking, either the player or John or Jim, or Fred when he was here. So yeah, it was definitely an amazing experience, and hopefully I can, take that next step and just give people more content from how I see it. So.
I think one of the best things that you actually did this season, you captured a lot of good video just during some of the press conferences during the practices. And I would notice, like, just seeing Jim Boylan's reaction from that viewpoint on some, questions that other reporters were asking, or just seeing how he deals with you guys, it was fantastic. Like, just from consuming that end of it, I thought it was very entertaining.
Yeah, it was when I first went there, it's like, okay, I'm here, I have the credential, what am I going to do with it? We have two people, two fantastic reporters and journalists that are already covering the team from our station, which is Cody Westerlund and David Schuster. They take care of the majority of the audio that you hear on the Score. And I was like, well, they don't need a third person just getting audio. So I'm looking around, okay, how can I find my, get in where you fit in, type deal. And I saw that nobody is getting any video of this. And me, I know that I'm a visual learner, and I'm a avid YouTube consumer. So I know that there's a market for people just wanting to watch versus listen to content that they want. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start video recording as much as I can. whenever I'm here, and it popped off. Like you said, people enjoy that content. I'm starting going back and forth with people because people don't get that inside look, you know, like that from practices in the locker room and stuff like that, or not too much basis, especially in this market. This is the third largest market, and nobody really outside of the Bulls media PR people are putting out video of the Bulls. So I was like, you know what? This is my lane right here. And everybody seems to enjoy it. So yeah, I'm definitely going to keep doing the videos, and I'll probably do a little bit more of that as I'm being trusted more to do with the Bulls.
And I think from our Twitter handle at, you know, Rebuildable, we'll probably be retweeting that as the season kicks off next year.
Appreciate
so it. We'll definitely be sharing a lot of that, because again, the perspective you got was amazing. So of course, with the theme of this podcast, Tony, we have our guests kind of lay out a rebuilding plan for the team. I'm going to take a slightly different direction here with the start, since you do cover the team. And I wanted to just actually get into the roster a little bit, because you got to deal with some of these players on a personal basis and in covering them. A lot of Bulls fans, you know, probably they're very high on Lauri Markkanen and Zach LaVine, Wendell Carter Jr. being that core. What are your thoughts on that core? Do you think that's something that, is there an alpha there, or do you have to search for that next alpha to go with those three?
Yeah, I don't think the generational talent that you need to win championships is in this core. And that's just being honest. These are very good players. Mm-hmm. Not denying that. They may make us, you know, all-star teams, you know, but as we've seen kind of with Toronto before they made the trade for Kawhi Leonard, that just because you have two all-stars doesn't guarantee you a finals visit. And I believe that the Bulls fan, we should hold the organization to that standard. And they should want to be held to that standard. You shouldn't be, well, if you make the playoffs, we'll be fine. Like, that shouldn't be what the Bulls fan wants. And unfortunately, that guy isn't on this roster. I like Lauri Markkanen. I like his skill set. And I like what he can possibly go into at peak Lauri Markkanen, but I don't think that version of Lauri Markkanen is a generational talent that you need to win championships.
Just to jump in with that, what do you think Lauri's ceiling could be? Like, is it top 30, top 40?
I think at peak, I think maybe he can be a top 30, top 25, or maybe a top 20 player in the league. I mean, his shooting ability at his height gives him a significant advantage, and he does have some moves, and he's an underrated athlete, actually. And I think that combination of height and shooting ability and getting to the rim ability kind of sets him apart from his other peers. But what I think caps off for Lauri is just, I don't know the mental aspect of the game. Now, that could change as he gets more mature and more used to the league, but I had problems with Lauri being okay with not having, you know, 10 plus shots a game. I saw that from Lauri this year, that he was just content with not getting the touches. And that bothered me. If I'm looking for an alpha guy, you typically know those guys, you know, almost immediately. Even in their rookie years, like, you see that, okay, that's the moment, or that's the time that I, even if it's a short stretch or half of season, that you see, okay, he's going to be a superstar. We saw that with Luka Doncic. We saw that with Trae Young. We saw that with Donovan Mitchell in his rookie season. You know the generational talent that can help you win a championship. Instead of, well, let's wait and see what he grows into. Like, those guys aren't mentioned in that conversation. But I do think Lauri can be a very, very good player, though.
It's interesting. So you said that top 30, top 25 area. And I feel like there's some Bulls fans that feel like that's slighting him. That still would be a very productive player. That's an all-star caliber player. And, like, there's nothing to sneeze at. You know, it's just, is he going to be Dirk Nowitzki level? I don't see it either. I feel like he hits a wall too much, and he's just not aggressive enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a slight. I mean, it's just again, they were talking opinions here, but I mean, if he gets to that level, excellent. I mean, that'll be great. But I also have to look at what's the most likely situation for that to happen. And the most likely thing is he's not going to be that. And I feel like we would have seen that already, even throughout his many injuries that have kind of held him back. We would have seen a stretch of dominance somewhere since he's been here. And I feel like I haven't seen it. I don't know if you have seen it, but I haven't seen it yet.
I've seen like really quick flashes. It might be like two or three games where he'll have like a 20 and 15, you know, type stretch. And you're like, okay, wow, you're starting to see it. But then he'll have a game where he goes, you know, 2 of 12 from the field and he's not getting the ball enough and not forcing the issue enough. And I think that's a that's a concern for me. Just if you're thinking he's going to be an alpha dog, what do you see in Zach LaVine though? Do you think that's a consistent all-star maybe down the road, or is he like flirting with all-star appearances as he goes in his career?
I think he's an all-star. I think he'll be an all-star. But again, like I said before, just making all-star teams and all-star games doesn't make you an elite generational or a player that teams can build off of to win championships. The timing with Zach is a bit different because he's already gotten his first contract. So his next deal will be the deal, you know, the one that sets the standard for his career on if he's a superstar or not. And he's a great scorer. He's an excellent scorer. He increased his playmaking ability just mid-season, which was great to see because at one point he didn't know what to do with the double team came to him. And I saw progressions of him getting better, passing out of those double teams, making the right decisions when Chris Dunn, either through injury or couldn't do it, Zach LaVine picked up on his end. Zach LaVine is not a good defender whatsoever. And I don't expect him to be a good defender going forward. But I like Zach LaVine. He's a good player. I think he's going to make all-star teams. But what one thing I do worry about is because of how his tenure started with the Bulls, where through injury, the first full year he had healthy, he had to be the go-to scorer guy. Now he's the go-to scorer guy for this team going forward. I'm worried if he'll hinder Lowry's growth, who I think is more talented than Zach LaVine, or whoever if the Bulls get lucky enough to have Zion or Ja Morant, will because he is ready to peek out into his all-star stardom, will that hinder the growth of people that may have more talent than him? That's the only thing I worry about with Zach LaVine being on this roster. But in terms of his play, he's certainly going to be a top scorer in the NBA.
And what do you think of Wendell Carter? We had a very small sample size of it, you know, prior to the injury. What do you think he can be going forward? Is he just a guy that's going to be a defensive staple, maybe at his best, or run-of-the-mill role player?
I think now, best case scenario, I hope he's similar, not exactly because Al Horford is a good player, but similar to Al Horford in terms of what he does defensively. And we've seen him willingness to take the three, so it, you know, space the floor with that. At least he's not, you know, Ben Simmons and won't take them. If he's open, Wendell will take the shot, and I appreciate that. But again, going into this draft, I was ready for the Bulls to take a big swing, and if that big swing didn't work out, I would have been okay with that because I knew that they were looking for that generational player to help them win the championship. But in typical Bulls fashion, they went with the high-floor guy, low-ceiling guy in Wendell Carter. I think Wendell can be an all-star. I think he can be a contributor to a championship team because I think he does all the things that you need a person that you need somebody to do the dirty work. You need somebody to rebound and block shots at the rim. You need somebody to do that on every championship team. And I think he can do that, But in terms of high expectations for him, is he a franchise changer? No. They may end up trading him depending on, you know, what happens in the draft if they get Zion. I mean, you can't bench Zion Williamson, and he's going to be in that 3, 4, 5 range. So how many – you can't start 5, 6 guys. So he may be gone. He may be. I don't know. But yeah, that's my thoughts on Wendell. He's a low ceiling, high floor guy. I think he's going to be a good NBA player, but I don't think he's a star at all.
So one more person that I want to get to that's on the roster, maybe on the fringe of being a core player, mainly just because of salary. Otto Porter, what were your thoughts on the trade when he was brought over day before the deadline, and what do you think his role could be on this team going forward?
I thought a couple things. One, the acknowledgement of mistakes. They shouldn't have signed Jabari Parker from the start. I was confused by that signing. It was weird. They didn't need it. I feel like that was just maybe a money slash jersey grab, you know, in terms of bringing the local kid home and kind of redoing that narrative because they missed it with Rose. But end up going sour anyway. So there was acknowledgement that they made a mistake in signing Jabari Parker. They also an acknowledgement that this current regime, John Paxson, Gar Foreman, Michael Reinsdorf, is not able to go in a room with a top free agent and convince him to come to be a Chicago Bull. They just can't do it. It's a track record now, and it's a narrative about them around the league. That they can't do that. So acquiring Otto Porter and his big money contract was an acknowledgement that for the next 2 years, we don't have to go into that free agent. One, because we don't have the money because of Otto Porter's large contract. But they also did get a good player. Otto Porter is a floor spacer and a defender, something that they vitally needed. Because Justin Holiday was not getting it done. and Chandler Hutchinson, I mean, he got hurt, but he, at this point, wasn't the long-term solution for the three positions to space the floor properly. So I thought Otto Porter and his jump, I mean, we saw the increase in, you know, the production in Lowry when Otto Porter got here. Just that added space that those other guys are afforded because Otto's on the floor was extremely beneficial. Also, his veteran presence, he's been into the playoffs, so his leadership, all of that was beneficial. But again, it also sucks that the franchise you root for is willing to acknowledge in certain ways that they suck at free agency. So that was also kind of like a warning sign for Bulls fans. Like, yeah, they acknowledge that they're bad at it. And then you're like, wait, they're bad at it.
Yeah, it was like a double-edged sword. I mean, really, because you are getting a solid basketball player, but it did take you out of the free agent running for the next 2 years. So it's a perfect description. And actually, I think that's a perfect segue into where I want to get to. You know, you mentioned the acknowledgement of past failures. And so let's say in a hypothetical world that did cause Michael Reinsdorf to have an epiphany, and he gave you, Tony, the chair, John Paxson's chair as VP of basketball operations. What would be your first order of business as a executive of this team?
Fire Gar Foreman, first of all. I would have to. He hasn't done anything of note that would help the Bulls going forward. It's just not there. And I don't need that lingering around for anything. Not for a quote, not for the narrative needs to change about the Bulls going forward. And I think firing Gar Foreman would tell the basketball world that it's the Bulls are changing, and we're changing for the better. And it's not just change for change's sake. So setting a culture, a renewed confidence to Bulls fans worldwide that this isn't the same old Bulls. That we're not, you know, depending on the legacy of the Jordan 6 championship years. We respect it. We acknowledge it. We're grateful for it, that we got those Jordan years, but we we can't live off that. We have to move forward and propel and give people a new reason to believe that the Bulls are heading into the right direction. So, and I think the first move would be firing Gar Foreman.
Are you looking anywhere to get your next GM? Do you have any names in mind, or are there teams you're looking at to kind of find somebody to do the standard day-to-day tasks as a general manager?
I think I would look under a couple places. Whoever's working with Jerry West. I love Jerry West. And I think he's an underrated I think he's probably the best basketball mind that we have in the NBA because of his work across the decades in building championship teams. I firmly believe that he built those Jerry Buss, quote unquote, Lakers teams. That Jerry Buss didn't have anything to do with that. It was all Mitch Kupchak and Jerry West. And Jerry, whoever's learning under him, I want to talk to them and use some of that for my franchise to rebrand it. Three other places I would look to, Utah and Denver. I've been loving what Utah and Denver have been doing with their scouting and their player development and their understanding that it's going to be difficult to attract free agents to these cities. So how do we win within the margins? So they went to advanced scouting, overseas scouting, player development, coaching. They went that route because just by the sheer location, they won't be able to get free agents. And again, look at what Denver has done. Look at what Utah have done via the draft, via their scouting and player development. And I want the people around that who helped build those two franchises. And one more place, I would maybe see if I can try and convince Masai Ujiri to come stateside and be in the number three market, because he's doing a fantastic job in a foreign country. And I like the risk takers. I do. I love the risk takers. I love the big swingers, but smart though. It's not just what the Brooklyn Nets owner was trying to do, just taking hacks for no reason. Mm-hmm. They're very calculated with Masai Ujiri, and I really like him, and I will pray that that Toronto gives me permission to talk to him so I could just give him all the power for the Chicago Bulls.
That would be an interesting move because he does have the cachet, I think, to sit down even in a room with players to convince them. I have a feeling he's going to convince Kawhi Leonard to stay. I have this gut feeling that that's going to happen. What are you doing with our crazy Uncle Jim? Are you keeping him as head coach, or are you thinking of having your GM go elsewhere for that?
They just signed him, and I'm just getting the team right now, and they just gave him the contract, so I'm kind of stuck with him, and I'm not a fan of paying people to go away, especially we don't know the details of Jim's contract, which is also weird. Yet we've known about his deal for a while. Joe Cowley reported it right after their final press conference, and he reaffirmed that on my podcast, No Zones, in our season finale. You can check that out. That's pinned on my Twitter. He also reaffirmed that Jim is going to be here for a while. And so I will see what Jim can do, at least for the first year, what he can do. But after that, if my evaluation is I don't trust him going forward, I would just have to let him go. And I will let my GM make that decision. But I would have a rule that no Ty Lue, no Jay Kidd, and no Derek Fisher. those would be my rules. Just not those three guys. I don't trust Derek Fisher. I don't trust Jason Kidd. And I feel like Ty Lue is just here for the championships and not for the building of the culture aspect. So not those three guys. I love Monty Williams. He has a job already. I loved him. But I would definitely give Mike Brown a try. I feel like he's learned a lot. I feel like he's had enough time watching what Golden State has done. And I feel like he soaked up a lot of it. Luke Walton, I think, should have stayed in Golden State. I don't think he was ready to be a head coach. And it showed, with that Lakers job, that he was not ready. So I think Mike Brown, who's had prior head coaching experience, He's got to be a part of a winning culture and what that looks like and what that feels like. So I would definitely probably at this point go to Mike Brown.
You know, it's crazy. People forget that, you know, when Mike Brown got that gig in Cleveland, he was a young, like, you know, the young hot name at that time, because I think he was on Greg Popovich's staff. And he's still, you know, a younger guy that probably could be on your bench for, you know, 8-10 seasons if you wanted. He's not an old guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not. Yeah, it's a perfect mixture of it. So, yeah.
What other areas are you maybe looking to shake up? Are you looking at your scouting department, you know, sports science, health? What are some other areas that you're kind of shaking up here?
For the immediate future, the scouting department, because right now the Bulls have to be honest. Nobody takes them seriously. And so in order to win within the margins, that's why I made the point of talking to people under Jerry West in Utah and Denver, because they know how to do that already, that they know how to look beyond just the obvious talent of a player and see what that player can be going forward in the future. And I want that. So at least for right now, we need to do that before we are able to go into these free agent rooms and try and convince somebody. We have to have proven that we are competent and can build. So definitely a shakeup in the scouting department. Also looking at the mental health, I think, of a player as well. Increasing the mental strength is a big thing for me. And you can say, you know, because I'm millennial, I'm more like sensitive to these things and whatever, but I took that seriously when Adam Silver said, when he talks to NBA players, that they're miserable. I took that very seriously. And I think to help grow the talent of the player, it can't just be the on-court stuff. I want to know what their thoughts are. I want to know, get their opinions on, what do you think about this philosophy or that philosophy in terms of basketball, just to figure out so I know that I'm getting the best out of this player, that his opinions matter, his thoughts matter, that when you come and be a Chicago Bull, you're a part of a larger thing, and you putting that jersey on, not to quote the cliches of Jim Boylan, but wearing that Bulls across your chest does matter. And you matter as a player. And so, yeah, the mental aspect of things is something that I would be big on.
You know, that's actually a really interesting perspective, because if you think about it, you play an 82-game schedule. You're playing in front of large crowds every night, and you go through this grind of the season. I can't imagine what the mental aspect of that would be like. Yeah. I think that's an interesting perspective, like, just see how you can maximize that.
I mean, I'm always in a, where is the market inefficiency is what it's called, you know, in business. And now they're using that thought process in sports, that if there's a way to maximize somewhere that people are overlooking, that's where I want to look. And I think the mental aspect is a space that is kind of overlooked because of the physical nature of the game. But when I look at Nikola Jokic, who isn't the most physical person in the league, but he has one of the highest IQs in the NBA. Like, I want to know that. I want to capture that. And I want to have that ability and think about those things when I'm building a team and when I'm addressing the roster and stuff like that. Like, it's not just about the X's and O's, because typically everybody runs basically almost the same thing. I want to know what you're thinking. Why did you make that move? Why did you make that cut? Did you know that there was a better option, you know, for what the move you just made? Just give them just another aspect of higher basketball playing, instead of just pick and roll, screen, stand, watch, shoot the three. Like, no. Basketball is a thinking game, and I want to get my team in that type of mode.
We have the draft lottery, of course, coming up this coming Tuesday. So you're actually going to be the last guest that I go over multiple hypotheticals and scenarios with here. So you should feel honored. Cool. So if the miracle happens that you brought up a little earlier, if the Bulls end up winning the lottery and they get Zion Williamson, how much do you think that changes the fortunes of the franchise? A move like that?
It changes a lot. I've said it on my podcast, and I said this when, you know, I think Zion, his talent is, excuse the language, but idiot proofs your organization to a certain degree, that he's so talented, and what could be done with him, no matter who your owner is, no matter who your GM is, no matter who your VP is, at least for the next few years that he's with you, people are going to take you seriously because of the talent that he has, the potential that he can become. And if the Bulls were lucky enough and fortunate enough to grab him, it would change so much. More national games. Look what he did for Duke. Highest ratings in college history because of him. It wasn't because of RJ. It wasn't because of Coach K. Coach K's always been there. It's because this unique talent was on there, and he was, ticket prices gone up. I mean, we could talk about the unfair justice system later about college sports, but they were
future podcast.
Right. They were certainly benefiting from Zion's ability and what he brings to the number three market, a internationally recognized brand like the Bulls. It will be game changing. And I don't want to say it will be more than what Rose brought. And look what Rose brought. You know, Rose brought in international attention. Yeah, but we haven't talked about a player like this since LeBron James. And we've had talented players come out the draft in between now and LeBron. Anthony Davis, John Wall, Kyrie Irving. There's been talented players, but nobody has had this hype since LeBron James. And he's on your team. That changes the landscape of what could be done for your franchise.
That's a Reinsdorf wet dream right there.
Yes.
that's actually a really nasty image. I shouldn't have put that out there. This is a hypothetical I like to throw out on some of the previous podcasts I've done with our other guests. If the New Orleans Pelicans came calling, and now that you've kind of changed the perception of the franchise, he's interested in signing with you long term, would you consider trading that number one pick to get Anthony Davis at, you know, on a long term deal too? So he's re-signing with you. Would you make that move or no?
I would say, it's difficult. But gun to my head, I think I'm going to say no. And here's why. I want to grow something organically and that's long lasting. And I think making an instant move like that won't get it done. And I think that if you just go with the flow and the trajectory of where you are now, because once you get Anthony Davis, you instantly have to win now, because he's right now, he's in the prime of his career. You're only going to get probably six, seven prime years of Anthony Davis to win a championship. I don't want to send out any false hopes to the fans that the turnaround from what this organization has been for the last decade or so is going to instantly do that. Like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a part of that. I want to have something grow organically and the correct and right way. And in the future, we're in 2 or 3 years where we're in a better position to make those big trades or acquire that talent via free agency, I will feel more comfortable doing that in 2 or 3 seasons versus right now, just because we have this kind of gold coin of the number one pick in Zion Williamson.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get more into the Zion hypothetical later as we start to get into sort of the offseason plan, but I want to just move on to some other draft scenarios. If the Bulls do end up with 2 or 3, what are you targeting? A lot of people say if it's 2, it's a lot of Bulls fans just think it's John Morant or bust at that point. What about you? Are you eyeing you know, John Morant there, or you got other players in mind?
Definitely John Morant. if you can't get Zion, John Morant is the guy. And that's just not even a thing. Like, I'm good with if they want to trade me Anthony Davis for the number two pick, that'll be fine. You know, but if I can't get Zion, John Morant is a go-to guy. I guess I'll be fine with RJ Barrett. But anything other than that, I'm good with everybody else in this draft, honestly. But me, I haven't, you know, watched a lot of college just because I know that the talent wasn't really there for this draft.
Yeah.
Next year is going to be more plentiful. But this year it was basically a 2 or 3 person draft. And I mean, there's always that some guy that nobody thought about. I can't tell you who that guy is because I haven't watched a whole lot of college basketball. So I can't tell you, is there an undercover superstar out there to be had in this draft? All I can say is I know two guys that are going to be in the superstar range, and a guy that in RJ Barrett that could maybe be a superstar. But everybody else, I just don't know, and I can't trust it.
Yeah, I feel like the sexy name that keeps coming off, if the Bulls end up in that like 4 to 8 range, you know, if everything goes terribly wrong, it sounds like Darius Garland's the one that a lot of Bulls fans are getting, you know, juiced up about, because, you know, he only played 5 games, had the injury, but he's a sharpshooter. But you're right, like, it's really hard to guess after you get through, you know, the first three, because I feel like it's such a steep drop off from 1 even to 2 and then 2 to 3.
Yeah, if I'm in that 4 to 8 range, I'm doing whatever I can. Like, after the lottery, after I know my position, and if I'm not in the 1 or 2 range, I'm doing whatever I can to see if I can move up to take who the Bulls need to change this franchise around. Because in my opinion, the rest of those guys, it'll just be picking another, well, who has the highest floor, you know, guy. And that's not going to change anything. I would do whatever I can, and if that means trading, I'm probably sure that Laurie is pretty much locked in with me. In terms of, you know, a guy that I think that I want to stay here. But everybody else, if that means trading Zach LaVine, if that means trading Chris Dunn or Wendell Carter to move up in the pick and maybe a next year pick, I'm good with that because I know I'm getting a generational talent in John Morant or not generational talent in John Morant, but a very, very, very good superstar player in John Morant and a generational talent in Zion Williamson. I'm good with that trade-off.
Previous podcast I brought up, and I want to ask a little more about John Morant here. I had said that the ceiling we keep hearing about is Russell Westbrook. What's the floor, though? Like, is it a scary floor for a talent like that? I mean, a lot of people are scared because of the small school. I know it gets me nervous sometimes, but what's your take? What do you think that floor might be?
I'll say what I said about Trae Young. If all goes wrong, he injures both knees, he breaks his arm, I know I have an elite passer on my team. If worst comes to worst, I have a guy with the smarts and the passing ability to set my offense, and I'm good with that. If worst comes to worst. And that is a skill that is needed in the NBA on every team. There's always an elite passer somewhere on your championship team or an elite playmaker that can get everybody else involved on that team. And I feel like John Morant at worst can do that. And I felt the same with Trae Young. If his shot is dead, if he can't get to the rim like he did in college, I know that he is an elite passer. And if that's all I get, I'm good with that because I know my offense at worst is set up properly.
Thank you for listening to the Rebuildable Podcast. Be sure to check out more episodes on Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Rebuildable.com.